Okay, first of all, let me thank the organizers for inviting me. I mean, this is a very daunting task, not only because I have only about 15 minutes and there will be 5 minutes for questions, so already think about what you might want to ask me in that brief time. But as was said in the introduction, there will be a stand where you can interact with me and my colleague Emily Whitaker about some of the issues that I raise and your general interest and concerns about science and the role you might play in the future of science. And that raises a very interesting point. Namely, as you all probably know, science has probably been the biggest engine for social change, certainly in the modern era. Right, so we have these major scientific discoveries. They're associated with great names like Newton, Darwin, Einstein, people of that kind. But in terms of how those changes actually get implemented in terms of transforming society, it typically requires the next generation to do it. In other words, usually the most receptive audience and the audience that is sort of best positioned to actually take forward the new ideas that science is putting forward now are people of your age. And so it's not too early in terms of thinking about a scientific career, especially if you're thinking about a scientific career where what you want to do is to advance ideas that at the moment are seen very much on the frontier of things, not necessarily fully accepted by everybody, but nevertheless there is some evidence for it, and so the idea is going to be to take it to the next step. I mean, because in case you haven't noticed, the older people who run the scientific establishment have already built into them a sort of vested interest in keeping the status quo going. And this is true of any field, and it's not just true of science, it's true of all areas of society. And so there's a sense in which no matter how open-minded, let's say, people of my age or older are about new scientific ideas, there will always be a resistance to actually move forward in those new directions. But of course, you younger people, assuming you're properly trained and so forth, you don't have that kind of investment already put in there of 20 or 30 years of research. So in that respect, you're trained, you're open-minded, you're in an ideal position to push forward. And this is the kind of mentality that I think really does need to be cultivated in schools. And I think, you know, my guess is that you people wouldn't be here today if you didn't already have it. Now, in the title of the talk and I'm obviously 15 minutes, I'm not going to be able to do the topic entirely justice, but I want to be able to give you some ideas related to it. And it revolves around a concept that is very popular now in Silicon Valley and California, and it's called visioneering. So it's basically taking the word vision and the word pioneer and putting them together and turning it into a kind of verb or a kind of way of being, way of doing. And the idea here is that you might say that science, especially the kind of science that really looks forward to the future and has the potential for transforming society, has to be able to do two things. On the one hand, you need the vision, right? So in other words, there needs to be a clear sense of the kind of sense of reality that you have. And all the great scientific discoveries, whatever else you want to say about them, one of the things that they have in common is actually a very clear vision of what it is they're talking about, right? So for example, we can talk about, you know, the DNA double helix, right? The whole idea of being able to image that was an incredibly important step. And it wasn't that people didn't know anything about biochemistry or genetics or anything like that before then, but having a kind of clear vision, something that was kind of, you could work on. And the same thing is even true if you go back to the 17th century with Newton. He had this kind of view of the universe as kind of clockwork, a kind of almost giant clock or mechanism that was designed and works in interlocking parts and so forth. And most laws of nature over the course of the modern era were modeled on that kind of conception. Okay, so you need a clear vision. There's no doubt about that. But in addition, you need the pioneering spirit. Okay, so in other words, it's not enough just to have the ideas, no matter how clear they are. Okay, I mean, because there's a sense in which, you know, you could just turn to literature for that. Right, a lot of very vivid ideas about the nature of reality and how reality might be and so forth is already in literature. Right, and often that has been an inspiration for science, in fact. But what makes the difference of science is you take those ideas forward and in some way you try to apply them, you try to implement them, and most of all, you try to test them. Okay? And this is the pioneering spirit because there is always the opportunity for failure. Okay? And I think sometimes when we teach the history of science, especially as a way of trying to inspire young people, we too often focus on the success stories and we don't spend enough time on the failures that are necessary along the way. Okay, and in a sense, if you think about all the great, you know, if you think about the word pioneering in a literal sense, you know, so in terms of, I'm from the United States, and of course, we have a whole big kind of mythology surrounding the move westward across the United States, right? The pioneers moving across, you know, very dangerous terrain, having to deal with the natives and all the rest of it. And the point is that, you know, there's a lot of casualties, there's a lot of danger, but there's enormous rewards at the end for all of those who do it. I mean, this was something that was even realized by Isaac Newton himself, who arguably is still regarded as the greatest scientist who ever lived, and he said, "If I have seen as far as I have, it is because I have stood on the shoulders of giants." In other words, he didn't do it alone. He didn't do it all in one go. It wasn't just a matter of one vision. Rather, he was relying on a lot of people, many of whom got themselves into enormous trouble in their lifetime for putting forward certain kinds of controversial views, even with evidence. Right? So evidence is not going to save you from persecution necessarily. Okay? And here it becomes really important, and this is one of the things that in a way makes science really distinctive from other forms of activities, especially ones involving knowledge, is that there is no assumption that science is to be concluded or completed just in your lifetime. It is literally an intergenerational project. Everybody is in some sense building on everyone else. And the expectation is that for any given individual, there will be a certain amount of success, but also a certain amount of failure. And the value of failure is that we can learn from it. Okay? Failure is not something to be ashamed of. It is not something to be humiliated over. It is not something to be a basis for excluding you from science. So science isn't just about the winners. The winners may be the only ones that we remember, but that is not what the whole story is about. In fact, Newton needs to be taken very seriously here, that it's all these other people that you forget about that in fact were necessary to have done the things they did in order to reach the heights that he was able to reach. So this is in a sense what the idea of visioneering is about. You have the vision in the first instance, but also you have, as it were, the will, the determination to follow it through, and to be able to realize that it's not going to be, you know, a completely easy ride. It will be difficult. Not only will it be difficult in terms of the intrinsic difficulty of science, nobody says science is easy, right? Science is hard, right? But not only is science hard, but even if you manage to score very well, you know, in your various examinations and everything, it's a very competitive market to get into anything having to do with science. So having scientific careers is hard, okay? And then the hard thing is to be able to convince your scientific peers and then later the public of the ideas that you have that you think are worth taking forward to society. These are potential hurdles along the way that many people fall down on. Okay, there's no doubt about it. There's a lot of sociological studies to show, especially women, fall down along the way, no matter how talented they are, because it is just a struggle. And there are means taken within the scientific establishment and within society at large to make it somewhat easier to move through science. But nevertheless, it is still a very difficult process. And at the end of the day, the ultimate difficulty is going to be to get people to see the world in a new way. That is the ultimate, you might say, the holy grail of science, is to get people to see the world anew. Okay, and that's what all great science is about, and it's not too early for you guys to think about this. Now, I want to say, in terms of where you guys are in your lives, where you find yourselves in history, you actually have enormous advantages that people, let's say, even a generation ago didn't have. And this has a lot to do not only with, again, for those of you who are young, you don't maybe appreciate this, but first of all, media coverage of science, however flawed it is actually more than it's ever been before, and it's more sophisticated than it's ever been before. Okay? So we actually live in a culture that is prepared and interested in science. You can get good ratings with science. Okay? This is a relatively new thing. And so that's a good thing in its own right. But I think even more importantly, from the standpoint of your own individual lives as young people, I actually think that a lot of the stuff that you guys normally do that you might think of as non-scientific is in fact contributing to enhancing a scientific vision. And in particular, I want to mention video games. Okay? And all of this kind of virtual reality stuff, I mean, in case you don't know, I mean, I'm sure you do know, apparently over 90% of boys and girls of your age, in fact, engage in some kind of video game activity to a substantial extent every week, and half the population of this country, regardless of age, does so. Okay? And one of the things that's very interesting about video games in this context is that it really puts people who are engaged in it in a kind of mindset of thinking about a kind of total reality, right, where you're forced to think about the assumptions that are going on in the world you're interacting with. You have to deal with issues of unpredictability, uncertainty, and you have to deal with quite a lot of complexity, which requires very clever responses over very short periods of time. Now, all of those, the skills, the intellectual skills that you develop in engaging in this activity, even if what you're just doing is shooting down people in the content of the game, okay, those intellectual skills can actually be used for the kinds of simulations and virtual reality mechanisms that are increasingly used in science to try to develop big visions. Okay, because as you know, you think about something like modeling global weather. Right, we live in a time where many people think we're on the verge of sort of global climate catastrophe. Much of the science that's going on now has to do with modeling the complexity of weather forces and how certain kinds of activities can end up changing what the whole game looks like with regard to the weather. That's not so different from what goes on when you guys are engaged in video games. Okay, so the capacities there, the facility that younger people have with computer simulations, virtual reality, actually prepare you very well for the next generation of science, because more and more science is going to be done that way. Okay, as we manage more and more complexity, we are going to be relying more and more on computer simulations. And these are exactly the sorts of things that are behind the video games that you guys are playing today. So the point here is that we are actually living in a world where, regardless of how difficult and technical the actual scientific concepts may be, and they remain just as difficult and technical as ever before, nevertheless, the kinds of intellectual skills that you're gaining just through your normal life, not just through the classroom, but from what you're doing outside the classroom, is actually preparing you better and better for science. Okay? I have to say that when I was a kid, and then this is many years ago, right, it was quite common for children to have chemistry sets. Maybe some of you have had these things. And chemistry sets were kind of ways in which you could kind of have fun and entertain yourself, but at the same time learn something about the elements and perhaps motivate you, to take courses in science and perhaps become a scientist yourself. When I was a kid, that sort of thing was of course very popular, was very well advertised, but also was seen as a little bit too nerdy, a little too fringy. But the interesting thing about video games and about computer simulations and virtual reality is that these things have penetrated all forms of life. Okay? And even though, some people might think that people who spend a lot of time playing video games, are nerds or don't have a life or something, they are turning out to be the majority of the population. Okay? And it seems to me that this is actually potentially providing a very good basis on which to think in the sorts of terms that actually practical scientific activity involves increasingly in the future. Okay? So, if you're interested in following this kind of idea up, because for some of you this may be obvious, for others of you this may be, heretical or brand new or whatever, there is a book I recommend called Reality is Broken by Jane McGonigal, who's an American, and this book was a bestseller in the New York Times a couple of years ago. And it basically shows how the sorts of skills and facilities that one develops in the video game context actually enables you to engage in very sophisticated activities involving science, and not just the frontline science, the basic research stuff of the laboratory, but also the kind of science that you need to model complex situations like solving the problem of global warming or global poverty for that matter. Okay, or for that matter, the spread of diseases and epidemics. So, for example, the thing that you raised at the beginning, right, this business of this epidemic that may be in the room you don't know about yet. Now, you can easily imagine this being turned into a video game, right? And being and at the scientific side of this, how one would isolate the relevant populations, how one would treat them, and so forth, could probably be developed much more effectively, you know, in terms of a computer simulation that would look like a video game, than just doing it here, you know, informally amongst us. So even this example feeds into this kind of enhanced kind of scientific skills that you are getting just through your informal life as students. So I'm going to end here to give a couple of minutes for some questions, but I just want to tell you there's a big future out there, there's a lot to do, and what you need to do to be part of it isn't so different from what you're already doing. Thank you. Questions? Yes, sir.
What is your field in science?
I'm a historian, philosopher, and sociologist of science. So in a sense, what I'm doing, and this explains why I gave the talk this way. I'm talking about the way in which science relates to the rest of society, right? And one of the things that one always needs to be concerned about from that standpoint is, where is the next generation of scientists going to come from? Obviously, the answer is going to be at least some of you in this room. And so then it becomes important to have a sense of, well, what do you need to know? How do you need to think about this issue? And that's kind of where I'm coming from on this. Other? Come on, there must be someone else here. Come on, don't be bashful. We will have an interactive stand, as I said, later on, if you want to talk to us personally. But it would be nice if we get another... Yes, sir. Yes, ma'am. Sir.
Did you always want to have a science career when you were younger? Like, when you were young, did you always want to have a career?
I never, to be honest, I'm one of those people who never saw science as so different from everything else. I think that's a very important feature, okay? But that's because I come from a background, and maybe this reflects a lot of the people here, where we're schooling, you know, and being intellectual and educated was always on the front burner. I come from a relatively poor background, okay, and so the whole idea of being intelligent and using your intelligence as a way to benefit society was just a given, and so science was already, was always kind of an option on the table for me. It wasn't seen as some strange career that only nerds do.
Yes?
Sorry. Who's my favorite scientist? What, living or dead? The dead ones are often easier to like. I didn't expect, but yeah, I realized now this is more provocative than it was meant to be. Well, let's put it there. But those of you who know I'm right. I mean, a lot depends. I mean, I think the way to think about the question, okay, and I'll give you an answer. I'm not gonna dodge the question. But a lot depends on what you think the point of science is. What is science for at the end of the day? I happen to think that science is actually the form of knowledge that can give us the best understanding of our place in the cosmos. So I have a very kind of almost metaphysical view about this. And so from that standpoint, someone like Newton is, to me, still the gold standard of science, because this was a man who developed a view of physical reality that was as comprehensive as it could have been for his time, and it was also embedded in a worldview that served to empower human beings. And in fact, much of what we call the modern era comes from Newton's way of looking at the world. One more question. They get better, yes.
Is there any way we can read some of your articles which you have written?
Yes, I mean, in the In the little blurb for this talk, I actually sent some links to things that were relevant. But frankly, if you want to contact me personally, you can do so, and I can, you know, I could send you stuff that way too. But I did send a couple of links to things. But it's not. There's a lot of. I've written a lot of stuff, and there's also some YouTube videos of the things I've said as well, because I'm particularly interested in how human nature is going to be transformed by science in the future. That's kind of the thing I'm most interested in with regard to the future of science, is how the way in which, especially within the biomedical research and also computer technology, is going to change what it means to be a human being. That's the kind of thing I'm particularly interested in now. And but in any case, I can send, you know, articles, links, whatever, if you just contact me.
Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you.